Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about Artemis by Andy Weir, because last night we had an incredibly brilliant night in the planetarium here in Bristol, what is now known as the We the Curious Planetarium. Now, last time we did some events there, it was called the At Bristol Planetarium. It's the same place, just a different name. The planetarium is just as wonderful, and we gathered there last night with Andy Weir and 100 people who were lucky enough to get tickets for the event to talk about, of course, The Martian, but also Andy Weir's new book, Artemis, and a whole lot more besides. And because we were in the planetarium, I wanted to take advantage of that. So we took people on a 3D trip to the moon and to the TRAPPIST planets. You'll hear a little bit of that, but most of what you'll hear is the conversation that we had with Andy Weir in We the Curious Planetarium.
Last time with Andy Weir. Hi everybody. Antonia, do you want to take us to the moon?
Hello. Oh, you're so cheerful. Hello, welcome. I like this audience. My name's Antonia. I'm one of the pilots / presenters of the planetarium. So I thought it would be amiss if we didn't use it to do a little bit of flight. But I don't want to just tell you about it. I want to actually fly us around. So pop on your 3D glasses, sit back and relax. And I'll start by opening up the dome. As humans, we spend most of our time in the daytime. We think about things we can see and interact with, our own affairs, our lives, maybe the weather. Only a couple of things have the power to make us think bigger and further beyond our world. In my opinion, two of the most powerful things in existence are books and astronomy. Because they have the power to transport us through time and through space, and to take us to other worlds.
So at this point, Antonia Forster took us on a trip to the moon in the planetarium. And it was just so wonderful. Andy Weir emailed me earlier to say how fantastic it had been, how much he loved it, and what, in his own words, what a hell of a venue. And when Ty and I had been talking about what we'd do the event, I thought, well, we've really got to take people to the moon, because they've got this planetarium where they can use real scientific data and then turn that into a 3D visual above on the 360 dome. Anyway, Antonia is wonderful. She did a fantastic job, both on creating the content and presenting it on the night. And I caught up with Antonia earlier today to ask her how she'd done it. So, Antonia, thank you so much for doing that. It was just so amazing.
No problem.
And I know the audience loved it, and Andy really loved it. But can you just tell everybody what the people in the planetarium were experiencing?
Yeah. So we started off on Earth looking up at the stars. Then we took off and had a look at Earth, and then we could see the moon over on one side. So I piloted us over to the moon, had a look at it. I faded up some of the markers to show the landing sites of all the Apollo missions, and spoke a bit about moon science and some facts about it. Then I kind of zoomed in a bit closer to the Apollo 11 landing site, and I created a marker to show where the colony of Artemis is set, based on some coordinates I got from a little bit of online research around Andy's social media. and then we faded down onto the moon to a panorama image. But there isn't, obviously, a panorama image of the actual site. So we did use a 3D model of the moon for flying around it. We got that data from an actual satellite, which is really going around the moon in real life, called the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and that takes pictures of the moon. So we built a 3D model of the moon, zoomed into it, and faded into this panorama shot. The panorama we used, the photo, is actually from the Apollo 17 mission with Harrison Schmitt, which is a slightly different landing site, actually. So we did essentially fake a moon landing. but please don't take that out of context. So the photo isn't a 100% reflection of the site we landed on, but it's fairly similar in terms of its kind of geology and things like that.
Thanks, Antonia. Pretty awesome, right?
The three of us are also in 3D.
So, while we're here on the moon. So when I open this book and turn to this page here, which you've all seen, right? A little tear coming to my eye because you've named the domes after the asteroid. Tell us when you did that.
Exactly. I just thought that would be very appropriate to name the domes of Artemis after the people who walked on the moon. And they're basically, as they build new domes to the city, they name them after the sequentially next person who walked on the moon. So the domes, they call them bubbles because they're actually spheres. They're half underground and half above. And so their names are Armstrong, Aldrin, Conrad, Bean, and Shepard.
Yeah.
And so if they build another one, it would be Mitchell.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When you're writing about Mars, because we had this conversation back in 2015 about the Martian. Right?
Okay, yeah.
And when you're writing about Mars, it was, you told me, because you basically were sitting there thinking, so if we did go to Mars, what would it take? And then you got this guy.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm a space dork, obviously, and I wanted to kind of design my own mission to Mars. And so I came up with, okay, how do we get the astronauts there? How do we keep them alive? And this wasn't even for fiction purposes. This was just a thought experiment. And I thought, okay, well, what happens if this goes wrong? What happens if that goes wrong? You need to make sure your mission plan doesn't kill the crew. And so I realized that the increasingly desperate things you'd have to do to survive might make for good stories, so I created an unfortunate protagonist and subjected him to all of it. Or I'm a small, petty god.
So was it an obvious choice to go to the moon next?
I don't know if that, I wouldn't say obvious, but it was... I wanted to write a story about colonization of space, not just exploration. And it's just clear to me that the moon is the first place that we will colonize. Going straight to Mars makes no sense. Like, colonizing the Mars before you colonize the Mars. Maybe I can get on the Google. Colonizing Mars before colonizing the moon would be like if the ancient Britons colonized North America before colonizing Wales. I mean, it's that level of inconvenience.
Yeah.
So it's clear to me, and I wanted this to be about humanity's first city that's not on Earth. And so this is what I came up with.
Okay. Well, listen, Andy has taken us to Mars, and he's taken us to the moon, and I wanted to give him something back. You can enjoy it too, don't worry. And I hope this is okay, Andy. I want to take you somewhere else.
Okay.
Antonia, take us somewhere amazing.
No problem.
No.
I start back on Earth. I'm best at piloting from my home planet. Okay, make sure you've got your 3D goggles back.
We're sitting there in the planetarium, looking up at the aurora on this strange alien planet, looking at these rocks, which, you know, rocks are rocks, aren't they? But, it's, but looking around, as you said, it's the closest that we'll get to standing on the surface of an extrasolar planet at the moment. So how did you do that? Did you just make it all up, or where's it come from?
So TRAPPIST-1 has been known for a while, but TRAPPIST-1e is a planet going around it. It's one of seven in its solar system. And that discovery was made in February last year, about February, March. So when that discovery was made, it was by looking through a telescope at the star and noticing that its light level dipped a little bit. And you can calculate from that how many planets are on it. You can also calculate the size and mass of those planets, how far they are from the star. And from that, you can deduce things like whether or not they might have liquid water and whether or not they have magnetic fields and things like that. So based on the data that we have from kind of the year since February, March last year, which is NASA has been working on it, I think ESA, CSA, JAXA, the other space agencies, we collated all of that data. So space travel and just kind of astronomy in general is a really well-documented, I think Andy Weir mentioned this as well, it's an incredibly well-documented industry. So you can find a lot of data, and it's freely available on the space agency website. So we took that and we commissioned imagery from exoplanet experts from the University of Exeter. And they created this image for us that we can land on and have a look around in. And they also created a series of other images, which we've got online as a kind of 360-degree VR experience. And you can actually go to several different exoplanets and look at their surface. One of them is entirely a water world. One of them is very volcanically active. But yeah, TRAPPIST-1e is the one that we think is probably most similar to the Earth in terms of size, mass, and its conditions. So it's very, very exciting. And as far as I know, I think that imagery is just... You can only experience it at our planetarium. Also, our planetarium is the only 3D one in the UK. Yeah. So if you do want to fly through space in 3D, you have to come here, really.
Totally. Do that.
Well, thanks, Antonia. It's just so awesome. I love that. Thank you so much. Oh, you'd like that. Genuinely, I was like, I saw that the other day when I was in here, and I was like, this guy's taking us to Mars, he's taking us to the moon, let's give him something. So I'm glad you're
taking the TRAPPIST 1e.
So is that where the next book's going to be?
I don't think so.
The one after, yeah? So last time we spoke, you were making this, they were making this.
Yeah, they were shooting it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was an incredibly exciting time to talk to you.
It was.
From my point of view, it went incredibly well. I love the film.
Yeah, it did all right.
Yeah. And it wasn't just that. You've been hanging out with Buzz Aldrin. You've just been to TRAPPIST.
Yeah, that's you.
But how has it been for you since then?
Well, it's been. It just seems really surreal. You fantasize about this sort of stuff when you're a writer, but you don't really think it's going to happen. It's like winning the lottery. And then, you know, it happened. The movie came out, the book did well, all that stuff. And then, you know, it faded down, calmed down, everything kind of got back to normal. And then it just seems like a daydream that I had or something like that. But you know, the checks keep coming. So...
Yeah, that's not too bad.
I mean,
that's
not bad, yeah.
No, that's good. It's good,
it works.
I mean, before...
Oh,
it's broken.
Before we get to Artemis, which we're obviously going to do, we should probably talk about how The Martian came to be. I mean, like every budding sci-fi nerd, you came up with a concept, you started publishing parts of it on your website, a publisher thought it was a good idea, published your first book... the rights were immediately bought by 20th Century Fox. Matt Damon got attached. It was directed by Sir Ridley of Scott, Knight of the Realm, and became a mega hit starring the likes of Sean Bean, Jeff Daniels, Chiwetel Ejiofor. How do we do this? Tell us.
Well, frankly, I'm surprised more people don't do this.
It sounds
really worked out very well for me. Yeah. I highly recommend it. It's one of those things where, you know, I still don't know what I did right. When I wrote The Martian, I thought I was writing for an extremely small group of hardcore science dorks who literally want to see the math in the text. And I had no idea that that would have mainstream appeal. And I don't understand how it had mainstream appeal. I just never imagined that millions of people would want to read what is basically a series of algebra word problems.
I mean, it is, your book is a hard science, hard on science science fiction book. I mean, when it got adapted by Hollywood, were you worried that they would try and take the science out of it, maybe put in a few bikini plaid aliens? Was there any point during the whole Hollywood process they were like, let's kind of dumb this down a little bit?
Not really. I mean, because Drew Goddard wrote the screenplay and he was originally slated to direct. The reason he left the project was because he got offered the director's chair for the next Spider-Man movie. But he, right from the get-go, he said the main thing that makes The Martian good is the realistic science, in that it just seems so grounded. And so he's got right to work doing the screenplay adaptation and had that there from day one. So I was never worried that they were going to, you know, dumb it down or get rid of stuff. Although Ridley did want to put Mission Control at Cape Canaveral, which I fought tooth and nail on, and it's, I think, the one concession that I got. Because, you know, when it's Houston...
Yeah.
That's what they call it. Right? When the astronauts are talking, to Earth they say Houston. Houston is rather famously not in Florida.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with the success of the film, Matt Damon, awards and everything, and you sit down to write...
Best Artemis. Musical or comedy.
Exactly. I mean, Golden Globes, they put it down, yeah. Musical or comedy.
Musical slash comedy, whatever.
Which one of those is it?
I don't know, you know, there's a lot of disco. Yeah. Maybe it's a musical.
When you were writing Artemis, did you ever think that this was a case of the difficult second album?
Of course. You know, I found that the southwest corner of my office is the best one to cower and whimper and cry in. Although the northwest corner does get good lighting. No, I mean, of course I was incredibly insecure about all this. I knew that I was following up The Martian, and which is like this ridiculously unprecedented success, the sort of thing that an author... The levels of success that an author gets once during their entire career, only if...
Nope.
Only if they're incredible. And so I...
Is this feedback? Is that what it is?
Do I need to maybe lean forward, get a further away from the speakers?
Maybe.
Yeah. And so I knew that there's a good chance that I can write 20 more books in my career, all of them things that people enjoy and give 4, 5 stars, whatever, and still not equal the success of The Martian. So I just had to make my peace with that. So for Artemis, I'm like, look, what I want is for people to read the book and then put it down and go like, that was cool. I enjoyed the time I spent reading that. Mm. That's what I'm shooting for. Mm. So far, it seems to have worked out well. It's selling very well. Mm. Although I think my laundry list would sell very well after The Martian. Not really an honest measure, but it seems to be consistently selling well. It's had some staying power on the New York Times bestseller list, which implies people are recommending it to each other, and that's the true test.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. So that's
thank you.
That's my test.
But you would say that, wouldn't you? I mean, I'm here.
It was rubbish. No, I probably honestly
wouldn't
say
that. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I didn't know.
I just wanted to say that to your face.
So I flew in just for that. No, I am going to ask you a difficult question, I think. So
right.
when we spoke last, you were talking to me about a different book, which was called Jack.
Yeah.
What happened to it?
Between The Martian and Artemis. So after the success of The Martian, I got right to work on my next book, which was called Zhek, Z-H-E-K. See, I said Z there. Are you proud of me?
Yeah. How long have you been
here? Right. Going native. I worked on that for most of a year, and I had a contract with Random House to do it, and it was a more traditional sci-fi novel. It had aliens and faster-than-light travel and telepathy and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. And I worked on that. I got about 70,000 words into it. For reference, The Martian is about 100,000 words. I got 70,000 words into it, and I was reading it, and I was like, oh no, this sucks. I've been sending chapters to my editor at the time, and he had been pointing out some problems with it. He's like, well, we have these problems. And I'm like, yeah, I know. Okay, I'm working on that. And I was just beating my head against the wall with it. I mean, the characters were fighting me. The plot was fighting me. It wasn't coming together well. I'm like, if I were reading this book, I would have put it down by now. Like, and so I finally kind of like went, okay, well, I've got this idea for another story, one, you know, takes place on the moon, and it's a city on the moon. I've got all this cool stuff in mind for that I've been thinking of in the background. And I thought, like, okay, well, all right. I talked to my editor and said, like, look, I'm really sorry, but can we push the big red reset button? I would like to write a different book entirely. I would like to scrap everything I've done so far. I'd kind of like you to add maybe a year on it. And they said, yeah, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, they could have delivered it a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Would have made me feel better. They didn't have to immediately agree that Jet could be scrapped. Yeah. So that hurt. You know, that was hard, but it just wasn't a good book.
Yeah.
And so I've set it aside. I may use it for parts later.
Okay.
There are some characters in the story that are pretty solid, a couple of plot ideas that are really good, but in its current form, I don't plan to finish it or continue it.
Okay. Well, you know, I think that happens to, clearly happens to the best of us. Just telling it how it is. And I genuinely love this book. I mean, it's
thank you.
It reads so easily. It's like, you know, it's a really beautifully put together thing. You can see the film.
Well, not yet, you can't.
No.
Give Hollywood time.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course I'm optimistic. You know, I'm hopeful. 20th Century Fox bought the film rights. They bought them outright, not an option, but a straight-up purchase, which is a good sign. And they've attached the directing duo of Phil Lord and Chris Miller to direct. And the next step, I think, will be those two will find a screenplay writer to make the adaptation. But Hollywood pretty much shuts down over Christmas time, Thanksgiving time, end of the year, and then they move really, really slowly until after the Oscars. So I don't know how fast that's going to move, but it's not going to be super lightning fast right now.
I was going to say, Lord and Miller have, they did the Lego movie and the Jump Street films, and they have game directing a sci-fi film in that they directed 80% of the Han Solo film before they got fired.
Yeah, no, it's really on that. It's fun because, you know, Disney owns Lucas, you know, Disney owns Star Wars.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they were working and they were having, you know, big conflicts with the Disney execs over exactly how the Han Solo movie was going to be made. So they left or got fired, or I don't know. I never really asked them for all the details. But they went to go work with Fox on Artemis, and now Disney bought Fox.
Ah.
So they're working for Disney again. I give them a lot of crap about that. I'm like, hey, guys, how's it going?
Our lawyers have asked us to use the word allegedly a lot. So allegedly they were fired because allegedly they were straying too far from Lawrence Kasdan's script. Allegedly. As a writer of the book.
Or so it is alleged.
It is alleged.
Okay.
Allegedly.
So it's allegedly alleged? You cannot confirm that it has been alleged.
I cannot.
Okay.
So I've heard. We're the duo who are known for ad-libbing, and the Martian screenplay stuck pretty close to your book.
Would you have
any qualms about Lord and Miller doing...
No, not at all. I mean,
freewheeling on your story?
No, their job... So my job is to write a book, and I do my thing. Their job is to make a movie that is... Well, in the end, their job is to make a movie that will be commercially successful. Hopefully, their path to commercial success is to make a movie that's good. There are other ways to be commercially successful and still bad, right? I mean, I think Batman vs. Superman was a tremendous commercial success, and it was crap.
I concur.
It was worse than that.
Yeah, but it was a commercial success, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So anyway, if they make changes to Artemis and stuff, but there's a difference between telling a story via a video medium and telling it via a book. Whatever changes they need to make... to make a good movie, I would want them to do.
Yeah.
I don't have this religious adherence to the mighty text that I shat out over the course of
I'm interested to know. When you're writing it, are you thinking about a film coming out?
I'm not really. I mean, it's in the back of my mind that, well, maybe someday, something like that. But I try to push those thoughts away. My job is to write a book. If I want to write a movie, I'll write a screenplay. If you try to divide your loyalties between writing a book or writing a movie in the form of a book, then you're just going to end up with something that's not good at being either one.
Hmm. Okay.
Let's talk about Artemis's setting, the moon. Why the moon? What made you go back closer to Earth after Mars?
Well, like we were talking about that earlier, I wanted this to be about humanity's first city that is not on Earth. And the moon is the obvious candidate for where that'll be. And the main conceit in Artemis is that the price to getting mass to low Earth orbit has been driven down by the commercial space industry. And it's been driven down far enough that middle-class people can afford to go into space, like space tourism. And the hardest part about getting to the moon is getting off of Earth. Once you've gotten off of Earth, it's considerably... It's not that much worse to go to the moon. And so with that conceit, it becomes economically viable to build a tourist trap, basically, city on the moon. Well, then I said, okay, what is the economy of Artemis going to be like? Well, it's a tourist economy. So I based it off of, like, Caribbean resort towns, where you have, like, the nice glitzy hotels and casinos and stuff like that, and then the more austere conditions for the people who live and work there. And Artemis is about 40 kilometers away from the Apollo 11 landing site. And so there's a train that'll take you there, and they have a pressurized area there called the Apollo 11 Visitors Center, and you can look out over the landing base, and you go through the gift shop on the way out, you know.
Yeah, no, totally.
Just like any other tourist.
That's going to happen, isn't it? The Apollo 11.
I mean, that's got to be the most. It's the most significant historic site on the moon so far in the moon's limited human history. about 50 years now.
Yeah. And do you have a sense of when it's going to happen?
Well, in the book, I have the book taking place in the year 2084, and because Artemis has already been around for 20 years when the book takes place, so I have Artemis being built, construction begins in 2064. And so that's about, I gave us about 45 years or so to get to the point that commercial space travel becomes a viable tourism industry.
Yeah.
Well, your illustrious president says he's going to help construct a moon base as soon as possible. So it could
personally
be soon. It could be soon. It's just to make the first lunar hotel, you know.
No, don't.
I don't talk about politics.
You do not talk about, which is interesting because your hero in Artemis, Mark Watney, was based on you, but
oh right, yeah.
But for Artemis, Jazz Bashara is a young 20-something Muslim female.
Right, which you know.
Obviously quite different from you.
Yeah.
How did you get to that decision where you chose that as your heroine? How did you get into the mindset of writing a female hero who is so far from you?
Yeah, well, Jazz isn't so far from me as you might think. Mark Watney is always, I've often said, is the idealized me. He's like, he has all of the qualities that I have that I like about myself and none of my many, many flaws. So he's what I wish I could become. Jazz Bashara is a little bit more what I am. She has like flaws, internal conflicts, shady, questionable morals at times. She's more like what I was when I was her age. Like, when I was 26, I was kind of a screw-up in a lot of ways, and she is too. So she really is a reflection of me, even if she's not the same color or gender. Yeah. But personality-wise, her main drives and traits. That having been said, the way I ended up with her as the lead was, first things first, after coming up with the economics of Artemis, I then designed the city and built that in my mind. How they build it, where do they get their aluminum, where do they get the oxygen? It's all from mining ore on the moon, spoiler. I designed the whole city in my mind at that point in its history. And only then did I start coming up with a story. And I did that on purpose because readers are a lot more clever than they give themselves credit for, and they can smell it when you adjust the setting for the convenience of the story. They can see it. There's like an inconsistency in the setting that they sense a disturbance in the force, and even if they don't realize it consciously, it erodes their suspension of disbelief at a lower level. So I wanted the setting to be completely defined, solid, and internally consistent, and then that is where the story has to work around the setting, not vice versa. So and now I had the setting. So the next thing was come up with a story. So I started coming up. I came up with an idea for a story. I kind of outlined it. Random House made me make outlines after I canceled a book. I came up with an outline, and here are the characters, and here's the plot flow, and here's what happens. And I had need of a lovable rogue kind of criminal, but not a bad person. And I said, like, okay, smuggler, actually. And she was only going to be in, like, three scenes in the whole book. And so I said, like, okay, well, Artemis is a very international city. What's a country I haven't used yet? Saudi Arabia. Okay, and we'll make the smuggler a woman, just why not? And that was how Jazz Bashara came to be. And anyway, for reasons completely unrelated to Jazz, that story just didn't fit for me. It wasn't working out. I'm like, this is not a very good story. It's not a very good climax. So I came up with, I'm like, ditch it, take the parts that I think were interesting, come up with a new plot line, new main characters, new everything. And Jazz was like a part that I'm like, oh, well, you know, that I do actually need a rogue, and so I'll just kind of bring her in. She ended up more central. She was now kind of a secondary character, but still very much not the lead, not one of the core main characters, but she was more filled out now. Her father was a welder, and she'd been an Artemis since she was 6 years old. I defined all that stuff. Anyway, the second storyline, again, I just decided that doesn't work. It's not feeling right. I didn't like where it was going. However, Jazz was kind of interesting. So I said, all right, well, what if I made a story about her? That means it would be like a crime novel or a heist novel on the moon. I'm like, yeah, that sounds good. So I made a story about her. And by this time, Jazz was so cemented in my mind as a woman who was born in Saudi Arabia, moved there, and she's a lapsed Muslim, all these details. Like, my imagination would have rebelled against me if I tried to change her into something I'm more familiar with. Mm. So I found myself writing a first-person narration from a, you know, Saudi ex-Muslim woman, you know. The only real challenge on all of that, on all the differences between me and Jazz, was writing the female point of view. Yes, she is from Saudi Arabia, but she's lived in Artemis since she was 6 years old, and so her cultural norms and ideals and beliefs are all Artemisian. And that's a culture that I made up, so I am by definition correct. So that's not a problem. Cultural issue is not a problem. Her father is very much, he's a devout Muslim, he's very respected, very honorable man, and he has Saudi culture, so I had to do a lot of research on that. But he's not the central character, and he's not the person who's telling the story, so... I that was fine, but telling a story from a woman's point of view, that was the thing I was most insecure about.
Okay.
And so I did the only thing I could do, which is subject matter experts, in this case women. I gave it to every woman in my circle of trust, like women who I could trust not to throw it up on the Pirate Bay, right? And got all their feedback on the voice, and like, please tell me anywhere where this. Because the last thing I want is for women to be reading it and get knocked out of the story, just like lose their suspension of disbelief because something that just seems like too male in the narration. And they gave me feedback, and I made changes, and that's kind of the best I can do on that.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, if the doctor can be a woman.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say, when I was reading it, I started reading it just as Star Trek Discovery started. Mm. And there was kind of a few parallels between the two main characters. In that, there was this kind of rogue, slightly rogue person who was insanely cool, and I liked that.
Interesting. I'd never thought of that, because I think, like, personality-wise, Michael Burnham is about as far from Jazz Bashar as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. Michael Burnham is very logical, rational, tends to make non-emotional decisions. Jazz is like the opposite. Michael Burnham has a very strong moral center. Jazz, maybe not so much.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I'm wrong. That's fine.
It's a discussion. You're objectively wrong, but it's a discussion.
There are a few Star Trek references in Artemis.
Absolutely.
There is one bit where someone's trying to figure out the code, yeah. And I was yelling out what the code was.
Before it was revealed.
You say you're staying away from politics, but a lot of the themes of Artemis is all about the haves and the have-nots, because it is a very rich city. There is that 1% theme there. Was that at the back of your mind at all when you were...
It was only in my mind in as much as I wanted to make sure not to appear to be saying anything about it.
Okay.
It is not... There's no message. It's not... I have no statement to make. It's not about wealth and equality. It is just simply predictive. I mean, any society is going to have the haves and have-nots. This is not a hashtag Occupy Moon story. some of the poor people are assholes. Some of the rich people are pretty cool. I mean, it's like there is wealth discrepancy, but it's not... That's not a plot element.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a motivator for Jazz, who is on the low end of that wealth scale, you know.
Let's talk about science.
Oh, okay.
Because, you're an engineer.
I'm not an engineer.
You're kind of an engineer. You're more of an engineer than I am.
How many trains have you driven?
None.
Well, then you're not an engineer.
Fair enough.
I know why you're saying that, but I didn't like that question.
We listened to the Star Talk episode where you talked to Neil deGrasse Tyson about the book. He hadn't read it. But you say when you write these books, you imagine Neil deGrasse Tyson is standing behind you.
Yeah.
When you're writing it.
Keeps me honest.
How do you research building a moon colony and the world of Artemis?
Well, it's Google. I wanted to come up with all the solutions myself. I wanted to invent everything from scratch. So I consciously did not go look up other people's ideas for how to build a lunar city. But for the most part, Google is my friend. I mean, I start with more than a layman's knowledge of this stuff because it's my passion. Everybody's knowledgeable about their hobbies and passions. And then, yeah, sure, there are lots of people at NASA who would happily answer my emails and stuff like that, but Google's faster. And the space industry is incredibly well documented. It's one of the easiest things there is to research because the people who work on it are technically savvy, so they know how to post their information online. They're very proud of it, so they're eager to post it online. They want people to read it, and there's very little in the way of military or industrial secrets in the space industry. Mm. In the future, I'm sure we'll have more of both of those, but for right now, if I want to know the exact thrust, you know, profile of a Saturn F1 engine 34 seconds into launch, I can find that.
Yeah.
And so it's very, very easy to research this stuff.
Yeah, you can find out that the world is flat on the internet, so you have to be careful.
That's true. You can also find out that the world is flat.
There's a post on your Facebook page, and somebody asked if we could ask you this. They obviously weren't paying attention when they were reading the book. I'll ask you the question.
All right.
How can he light a cigar in 100% oxygen?
This comes up a lot. People misunderstand. Well, they don't... In the end, it's my fault for not adequately explaining it, because I'm the writer, so the fact that you asked the question means that I'm a bad professor. Basically, it comes down to this. Artemis's atmosphere is 20% of Earth's atmospheric pressure, well, actually 21% of Earth's atmospheric pressure, and it's 100% oxygen. That is the same amount of oxygen, if you imagine the total number of oxygen molecules in this room. It would be the same if this room were in Artemis. So fire burns at the same rate in Artemis as it would on Earth at sea level. It's called partial pressure for those who care. What everybody knows about oxygen and fire death is the Apollo 1 disaster. And what happened there was Apollo 1, actually the whole Apollo program worked this way, by the way, 21% atmospheric pressure at pure oxygen. But while they were testing Apollo 1, they wanted to have it have a positive 21% atmospheric pressure, but they were testing at sea level, so they pumped in 121% of Earth's atmosphere of pure oxygen. So now we're at like 6 times the total amount of oxygen density. And when you do that, everything's flammable. You're flammable. I mean, it's that. You. Not him. Yeah. Well, that's a superpower thing. We'll talk about that offline. So in Artemis, fires would burn at the exact same rate as they do at sea level on Earth. Complicating matters is that Artemis has extreme fire safety codes. It's one of the few laws that they have all relate to like fire safety. And so that compounds people misunderstanding this plot point. The reason they care about fire safety is because there's pretty much nothing worse than having a fire in a pressure vessel. It's like having a fire. Imagine if you're, you know, in the middle of a fire in a submarine. There's nowhere for the smoke to go. There's nowhere for you to go. That's why they prohibit anything flammable.
Absolutely.
Why jazz smuggles it in.
The other thing that's different than pressure noise is the taste of things, right?
Yeah, things taste pretty bad in Artemis.
Well, even single malt whiskey.
Oh, wow, what have we here? Sorry, let me get this bullshit water.
That's all right, we got more glasses.
Ooh, yeah, I like this.
Very good.
Welcome to Bristol.
Yes, I have a friend of mine who likes to go into bars.
There you go.
I have a friend of mine who likes to go into bars and say, I would like whichever scotch you have that has the fewest vowels.
I'm guessing when you're writing it, because when you wrote The Martian, you talked about potatoes a lot, right?
So you got
it came up, yeah. And people presumably gave you potatoes. So
yes, they did.
Yeah. So this time you wrote about coffee and single malt whiskey, right?
Yes. But this is not reconstituted as it was in the book, right?
Cheers.
Cheers.
it.
This is how we normally do the podcast. Smooth.
Yeah, no, that's delicious. And now things are just going to get more and more interesting. So on the subject of how things taste in Artemis, they taste pretty bad for a variety of reasons. First off, shipping food to the moon is doable but expensive. And so unless you're willing to spend what works out to be hundreds of pounds a day in modern money to eat, you have to eat locally grown food. And the only food they grow locally is it's chlorella algae, which is just a blue-green algae that grows naturally in the ocean, and they grow it in big vats in Artemis. The locals call it gunk. It tastes awful. I was ambushed on a live interview. Someone said, like, oh, yeah, chlorella, we have some here. And here you go. I guess the best way I could describe how it tastes is Poseidon's salty asshole. It's revolting. It tastes like concentrated seaweed, and the flavor doesn't leave. But we assume that our heroes in Artemis have flavorants and extracts and stuff like that to make it more palatable. But still, you know, okay, you have this thing that makes it, you know, you have this artificial oatmeal flavor. Well, now you have gunk that tastes exactly like artificial oatmeal. That's if you're poor, you eat that. If you're wealthy, you eat food that pretty much had to have been frozen or freeze-dried or something like that. Complicating issues is the fact that at 0.21... I'm going to answer now. I'm going to give you a secret. A secret that no one is allowed to tell Jerry Seinfeld, or his career will be ruined. Here is the deal with airline food. One of the main reasons airline food tastes bad is because your taste buds don't work correctly in lower atmospheric pressure. And so they get dulled. So the flavor goes down and down and down. And so in Artemis, where the atmospheric, you're getting all the oxygen you need, but the atmospheric pressure is 0.21 atmospheres, the taste buds are dulled. So even if you eat something that would be delicious on Earth, it tastes kind of bland on Artemis. Mm-hmm. Which might be good for the chlorella, because that's nasty stuff. But then also it comes up in the book, coffee and tea taste bad. Why? Because water boils at 61 degrees Celsius in 0.21 atmospheres. So that's as hot as your coffee or tea can be. And that's as hot as the water's going to be while your coffee or tea is steeping. Yes. Again, a bunch of British people going... Now, I have gotten more feedback on that one throwaway line in the book. People are like, no. You could use a pressure cooker. But in the end, it would still just be 61 degrees while you're drinking it.
The other thing that I love about the book is that the main currency on... Don't worry, we're not going to get into spoilers. This is just broad details. But the main currency...
The prolonged lesbian sex scene.
Oh, that was great. The car chase.
Seems really...
With a barrel roll flip over the moon.
In retrospect, maybe 50 pages was a bit more sexy.
I love the fact that the main unit of currency is basically what you can import to the moon in weight.
Yeah.
How did you come up with that idea?
Well, it just comes naturally when you're a genius like me. I mean, it's a gift and a curse. No, it's just a gift. I figured that one of the main things... Artemis's whole economy basically revolves around importing stuff from Earth. It is very much not Earth-independent. It needs supplies and stuff from Earth, and it imports basically a lot of its food and most of its money in the form of tourism. So... because of this, one of the most important things is the cost of transporting goods from Earth to Artemis. And so because of that, there's a company called the Kenya Space Corporation. We'll probably touch on that in a minute. And you can prepay for a weight allowance to be shipped to you. And so they call their currency slugs. It's SLG. It's just short for soft-landed gram. So one slug will get you 1 gram of cargo transported from Earth to Artemis. So if you've got something that weighs about 1 kilogram, well, that's going to run you 1,000 slugs to get it transported, which is awesome because it helps you calculate things. Like, let's say, how much does it cost to send the latest iPhone
to Artemis. Well, it weighs about 100 grams. Well, that's 100 slugs. Okay, so that means that the price of an iPhone is not significantly higher in Artemis than it would be on Earth. Now, if you've got your, you know, favorite four-cushion sectional couch, the vast majority of the price of that on Artemis is going to be the cost of shipping. So,
yeah. I was going to say, let's talk about the Kenya Space Station.
Yeah, the Kenya Space Corporation. So, within the conceit of Artemis, the commercial space industry, oh, well, in the real world, I'm not allowed to lean back. Yeah. In the real world, I've talked to lots of people who are in the space industry and private space travel and whatnot, and they all agree that the main impediment to private space travel is no longer technology, it's policy. And it's like U.S. policies, Russian policies, European policies on what it takes to get permission to launch things into space. It's just this huge pile of red tape. Kenya, in like my fictional Kenya, sees an opportunity to draw the global space industry into its borders by saying, we're not going to be a pain in the ass. If you want to launch from here, just file a flight plan so we don't crash planes into your rockets, and other than that, we're fine. And they also do everything to encourage a whole bunch of global corporations to put money in together to make the Kenya Space Corporation, which in turn gets all sorts of special tax breaks, although not zero. Kenya wants to get their share. And special labor laws so that, you know, oh yeah, you can union bus, that's fine. It's not friendly. This is not necessarily a fairy tale situation. It's just one that they successfully bring the global space industry into Kenya. So Kenya had two things to offer. One of them is policy, friendly policy. And number two, Kenya is on the equator. And launching from the equator takes the maximum advantage of Earth's rotation. Any point on the equator is actually hauling ass. It's going about 500 meters a second. You need 7,800 meters per second to get into low Earth orbit. So it's about 1 part in 16. It's a very significant fuel savings if you can launch from the equator. And Kenya is literally on the equator. And then finally, Kenya, nicely situated on Africa's east coast, means you launch out over the ocean while taking advantage of the equatorial motion. And so that means any launch failures or problems just fall into the sea, not over potentially populated areas. Like if Cote d'Ivoire wanted to do the same thing, they'd be launching over mainland Africa, which would be much riskier.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm going to just kiss your bum again. When I'm reading it... When I'm reading your books, right, it's a great joy as a fellow nerd to read your books. Because you said something to me back in 2015. Where you said that you would go and write.
Get out of my bushes.
Yeah, right.
The restraining order says 500 yards.
Yeah. And I said, I've got a microphone. You can hear me.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then we got on to talking. And I one thing led to another. And I said, you said that you would spend like a couple of days on some maths and then realize it was one sentence in the book.
Yeah, that happens all the time. Yeah. It's really, really hard to resist the urge. I want to, you know, it took me a long time to work this out. It should take you a long time to read it. You know, you have to resist that feeling because I have to remember that things that are awesome to me are not necessarily awesome to other people. Like, so yeah, I'm a space dork, that much is clear. I'm also an economics dork. Most people aren't that interested in, I mean, if anything, we've learned from The Phantom Menace, don't start a science fiction story with a description of supply-side economics. But to me, that stuff is really fascinating. So I ended up writing...
Do you like that film, then? Do you like The Phantom Menace?
No.
Oh, okay.
But not... I didn't have a problem with the economic stuff.
Jar Jar. The Phantom Edit.
Yes, quite good.
Yes.
I
love The Phantom Edit. You don't?
No, just all three of the prequels are terrible. Just don't bother. Place the crown.
Yeah. Here we are in Bristol.
You'll never find a more handsome crown.
So I actually wrote like a 10-page paper for Business Insider about the economics of Artemis. So if anybody's as dorky as I am on the economics front, you're welcome to find that. You can probably find it by Googling around.
Well, it gives me a lot of joy to read it. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, thank you.
Not the economics.
Out of the bushes.
Yeah, yeah. And you need to stop writing about economics.
That's very exciting.
Really weird. There's one of the things that I love about space travel is the possibility that we might start to get along a bit better.
Okay.
It doesn't really happen in this book.
Yeah, I mean, I don't get into it. I don't talk about, you know, this is a story about a heist on the moon, so I don't talk about what the political situation is on Earth. Within Artemis, the people there, they come from all over the world, but they really mostly consider themselves Artemisians.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But do you think it's inevitable that humanity will carry on being just as awful as it is when we go into space?
The short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is I don't think we're as awful as you think.
Okay, thank you.
I have a fairly positive view on humanity. I think we consistently make the world a better place, and we just think that we're ruining it. And, yeah, we do bad stuff, but pick any arbitrary year throughout all of history in your mind, okay? Now think of the year 100 years before that year. Would you rather live in the latter one or the earlier one? In almost all cases, you would rather live in the later one. You pick any year, 1858. Okay, you want to live in 1858 or 1758? You know? So we are continually, as a species, making life better for humanity. And I think if you ask people 100 years from now if they'd rather live then or now, they would rather live in the future, you know, where they're from. And so I've never bought into these dismal dystopian futures where only a few plucky teenagers can save us from the quasi-fascist technocracy. I don't like that. That's not my view of the future. I think we've done a fantastic job as a species.
At this point in the evening, Maddie had put together a game, which we did in the planetarium. It was so much fun. Again, it won't work just with the audio, but Maddie showed us pictures of what appeared to be, or actually were, Mars, and the audience had to decide whether they were Mars or not. It was a huge amount of fun. Andy Weir didn't get them all right, it has to be said. But we'll let him off. And after the game, we went to the audience.
All right, I think it's time to get some questions from the audience. So if you want to put your hands up, if you've got a question for Andy, and I'm going to roam around with the mic. So, Andy, do you want to pick your victims?
Yeah, let's start with this guy.
Oh, the failed counselor.
Hi, we tried to get you to Space Fest last year, but you were busy.
Oh, was I busy being a coward who was unwilling to fly?
Do you find it depressing that in every other area of science apart from human spaceflight, we seem to have gone no further forward in the last 50 years?
You don't feel like we've gone further forward in, like, medicine?
No, in every other area apart from...
Oh, we have gone forward.
Yeah.
Okay.
In every other
misunderstood.
Aspect of science, we've
okay.
gone forward, so human spaceflight.
I mean, I would like us... I think we're just starting to make progress now. We needed enough incidental technology to get to the point where we're developing a better mousetrap, so to speak, in rocketry and boosters could have a financial upside. Because in the end, it's just not worth sinking billions of dollars into something that you will guarantee not to get back.
Like the banking bailout.
Well... If developing a better booster could, you know, slow down the collapse of your economy, then we probably would do that. Or what was the other thing? High speed rail or something?
Well, HS2 in the UK is going to cost what the Apollo program would cost, which is depressing for a train line between London and Zambia.
Like adjusted for inflation?
$110 billion.
$110 billion. Wouldn't it be cheaper just to pay for everyone's cab fare? I don't do politics. I sure as hell don't know anything about domestic British politics, so I won't say anything.
John?
Who, what, where?
So I had Artemis-related questions, but they were either answered earlier or quite spoiler-heavy. So
all right, next.
So I was just wondering who your favourite Star Trek character was.
Ooh. My favourite Star Trek out of all the series is?
Yeah, and you like?
Oh, wow. You caused me a vapour lock. Oh, man.
It's 7 of 9, by the way.
No, wasn't that in the Voyager? Quark. Yeah. A little bit of Rick Blaine, a little bit of, yeah, I like Quark. You gotta love Ferengi. So I'm gonna go with Quark. How about you?
It was just something I noticed. Sorry, I forgot your name.
Don't worry.
You said you opened the book and you saw that the diaries were named after the Apollo, the Apollo people who landed on the moon. Now, don't judge me for this. I thought it was rubbish, but I was watching the new Fantastic Four film. There was a line in it where Dr. Doom says that he hates that the only people who are remembered are the people who landed on the moon, who essentially did nothing. All they did was sit in a capsule that many other people designed with years and years of study and practice, and eventually they were launched by other people, controlled by other people. The astronauts really didn't do very much. So do you not feel, especially as you describe yourself as a math geek,
I am,
that you wanted to honor the people who did the real work?
Hundreds, and like there were literally hundreds of thousands of people who worked on the Apollo program, so hundreds of thousands of people were responsible for putting Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and also Michael Collins at the moon. But only those three would have died if it failed. So it's a very significant difference. They're the ones who took the risk, so they're the ones who get remembered. And actually in my dedication, I dedicate the book to the command module pilots.
Yeah, it honestly doesn't matter who I am, but the...
for the rest of tonight, you will be known as Dudley.
Okay, so I've met a few Apollo astronauts, and they'll all say exactly what you say, but I think that they're wrong from what Andy said. But also, they worked incredibly hard to become those astronauts. They worked incredibly hard once they became those astronauts to be the astronauts that went to the moon. And just because they have a humility, it doesn't mean to say that we should join them in that denigration of themselves.
Really. Yeah, Dudley's right.
Richard?
Hey, I'm just saying.
I have a loud voice. Jazz clearly means a lot to you. I mean, the essence of her character, you said yourself, it clearly, you didn't want to change anything about her. And earlier as well, you said that with the directors, that if they wanted to make a change, that it would be something that, you believe they would do for good reason. What if they wanted to make a change that you fundamentally didn't agree with? For example, like Hollywood is accused a lot nowadays of whitewashing their characters. Yeah. So if they did something like that, do you even have a say in it, or is it something you're just like...
I have no say whatsoever. I mean, I tell them how I felt, but I can't stop anything or do anything about it. I would not like that if they did that. However, I happen to know from I hung out with the directors that we've talked about, how to do this, how to do that. It's very clear to me that they want to get a woman who can play the part of a Saudi convincingly, physically. So actually they're going to start by looking for actual Saudis, actresses, and then kind of work out. If they can't find someone they like who's a Saudi Arabian actress, then they would move out to other Middle Eastern, countries, and then move out maybe to Bollywood and South America and stuff like that. But they want someone who will look the part.
So it won't be like, I don't know,
Jennifer Lawrence.
Actually, if you saw the Marvel Punisher series, there's Amber Rose... Rivara? No, Rose Amber Rivara, who plays an FBI agent. I think she's a British Middle Eastern accent. She'll be good as Jazz. If you have any say.
I haven't. Again, no say.
Pass on my suggestions, Yeah. Hollywood will love it. Question.
Hollywood will love it. Yeah, sure. You can go ahead and feel empowered and decide for yourself. Oh, not that fucking.
I wondered how you structure these stories in your book. So obviously, a lot of the craft that people talk about when they talk about writing is the nitty gritty of grammar and all that kind of stuff that you learn in English classes. But how do you structure a story in terms of the beats? Do you put them on post-it notes on a board and kind of connect them, or is there actually not that much thought put into it?
It's a very complicated process. No, I really just kind of make it up as I go along, and then most of my writing comes in the form of editing. So pace is what you're talking about. It's the most important thing. It's like you have the beats of your story, but you have to make sure they happen at a reasonable pace. And that is the tricky part. So I tend to have a fairly fast narration. I would rather give less information than I could than have it take longer for to get to something interesting. But yeah, no, that's a really subtle nuance. There's no simple answer to that. See? You're taking control. Feels good, right?
Feels great.
Yeah.
This actually brushes off the lady's question over there. About when she mentioned about whitewashing, I thought it was a rather odd choice in The Martian that Vincent Kapoor's character was played by, is it Ejiofor?
No one can pronounce that. Should we tell Ejiofor? So in the book, his name is Venkat Kapoor, and he's ethnically Indian. He's obviously an American by birth. I mean, he works at NASA. But so the question is, why did this ethnically Indian character, become a black guy? The answer is because we had Irfan Khan lined up to play the role until 3 weeks before shooting, when he backed out because he had an unexpected clause of a Bollywood contract activate, and he had to go to India to do reshoots on a different film. And so 3 weeks before the movie began filming, we had lost our second most important role in the movie. And so we said, we no longer have the luxury of targeting a specific ethnicity. We want to get the biggest name we can possibly get. And so we got Chiwetel Ejiofor, and he did a fantastic job. It no longer made sense for his name to be Venkat Kapoor, so we changed it to Vincent. And there's a quick throwaway line in there where it's made clear that he's half Indian, half black, because he mentions, oh yeah, my mother is a Hindu, my father was a Hindu, my mother was a Baptist, and his last name remains Kapoor. It's the best we could do. Oh, and by the way, I've since learned from many Indian friends that the name Venkat Kapoor never happens. Venkat is from one subculture in India as a first name, and Kapoor is from a completely different subculture in India, and rarely do the twain meet. So you could have somebody named Venkat Kapoor, but it would be the equivalent of an American named Shaniqua Goldblum.
You mentioned earlier about the music, and this is with relation to The Martian, and I think...
Of course, nobody cares about stuff after that. No, let's talk about your stuff, you friend.
But a lot of grief is given about disco music. But whatever happened to his own USB stick?
Just... That is a question I get asked all the time, and my answer is always, I forgot. Ask her to... I mean, I could come up with something elaborate, like, oh yeah, you left it on the MAV, oops. But no, I just didn't account for what his own entertainment was.
But what would be on it, then?
I don't know. Don't make me write. Give me a contract, I'll write that.
Should we do two more?
So it's just... thinking, obviously, I think probably most people in this room have a book on the go somewhere on their hard drive which they don't ever want anyone else to read. But what are the tips for people when we're all busy for finding time to actually write your book and then not feeling, this new year, everyone's had a resolution that's going to write, and then you never do it and you feel really guilty. Have you got any tips for that?
In my case, the best advice I can give is what really helped me in finishing The Martian was not having a social life of any kind and just generally being bored all the time. So here's my advice for writing. In terms of making the time for it, that's just, I mean, your life balance, you have to deal with it, but you have to be motivated enough. My tips for writing in general, though, are, number one, you have to actually write. Daydreaming and thinking, you have to put words into a document. Thinking about how awesome the plot's going to be, that doesn't count. That's daydreaming. It's when you actually start writing it that you start finding all the problems in your story, and that's when you can start fixing them. Number two, and this is hard, resist the urge to tell your story to your friends and family verbally. You have to resist that urge. Especially if you've got a good idea, they'll prompt you for more, and they want to hear more, and they're actually interested. They're not just indulging you like they usually do. And it's really hard, but you need to resist that urge. And the reason is because most writers are driven by a desire to have an audience. And by telling the story verbally, it satisfies that need, and it saps your will to actually write it. So make a rule for yourself that says the only way anyone experiences a story is by reading it. You can still, write chunks and hand them out to your friends a chunk at a time and get the sweet, sweet validation that you crave. But just make sure you write it first. And the last bit of advice I'd say is there's never been a better time in human history to self-publish. There's no longer an old boy network between you and the reader. You can go straight to e-publishing. With absolutely zero financial risk on your part, it's great. Worked for me. We got one more or what?
Any other questions?
I mean, I've got one. How can Aquaman talk to whales?
Okay. So, Aquaman, you asked. Aquaman is actually an incredibly powerful telepath, and he has tremendous mental powers. He's also resistant to mental powers, so he can talk to pretty much anything. He just has more experience with talking to sea life mentally. So it has nothing to do with whether or not it's a fish or a mammal or an aquatic mammal or anything like that. It's just things in the ocean he has more mental communication experience with.
So I'm just going to do two more because I want to. So Alex, go on then.
I was just going to say first things first. Beyonce would make an amazing actress. And thank you for correctly pronouncing Chiwetel Ejiofor. I appreciate it. What do you feel about Kerbal Space Program?
I get asked that a lot too. I don't play it. The one axis of nerdosity that I don't really fit into well is I'm not that into video games. I'm into board games, so it's even sadder, really. Kerbal Space Program, you manually control the ascent. That's not what I'm about. I'm about doing the math. So, and I know there are mods and stuff that you can get to do pre-programmed ascents, but that's not, it's not my thing.
I've got a question. Would you go live on Mars or the Moon?
No.
If you have the chance.
Now ask me if I go into space.
Yeah, would you go into space?
No. I write about great people. I'm not one of them. I'm an earthbound misfit. And people are often surprised by that. What? You write about space? You wouldn't go into space? Yeah. George R.R. Martin writes about Westeros. Would he want to live there?
Fair enough. Philip Pullman talks about the forest, and you pick your path through the forest. So you've made a forest on the moon. Are you going to go back there, tell us more stories?
Yeah, I'd love to. I had already decided if Artemis sells well,
it did.
I'll be writing sequels, maybe prequels, just things that take place in the setting. Not necessarily with the same characters. I'd like for it to be kind of my own personal Discworld, like the way, Terry Pratchett told stories all over that setting, but not necessarily a single serial story.
Okay. And are you going to take us anywhere else apart from the moon?
I don't know. Right now, I'm just thinking about Artemis at the moment. It's not like I have some grand plan.
Okay. I'll let you off. ladies and gentlemen, Andy Weir.
I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you so much to everybody who came to the event. I know that there are a few of you listening who really wanted to be there and either couldn't get tickets or couldn't get there having got tickets. I'm so sorry. And I hope that being able to hear the audio from the event has somehow made up for that. The most common question that I had after the event last night was, what are you doing next? I don't know, to be honest, but we'll work something else out. And thank you so much to Andy Weir for joining us. What an absolute pleasure it was. Thank you so much to all the people behind Andy Weir, Emma, Ashley, Tess. It was such a pleasure to work with you all putting this together. Of course, thank you to Ty and Maddie. And Antonia. Now, Antonia is going to come to the shed and we're going to do an episode all about ants and bugs. But most of all, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.